Days are growing shorter, nights are getting long. Soon the autumn leaves will fall, just like in the song. And when the leaves are on the ground, a choice I'll have to make. Do I use the big old blower or be a man and use the rake? Yeah, good to be back, folks. Can't leave this post for long because things begin to pile up. It's always so busy in the world of arts and culture in Western Wisconsin, and it's our privilege to talk with the people and about the places. Man, what a show we have this week. Comedian, TV, and movie star, and all-around good guy, Louis Anderson, joins us by phone to talk about what he's been up to. He'll be appearing on September 21st at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. Jim Oliver welcomes Becky Livermore of the polka and variety band Barefoot Becky and the Ivanhoe Dutchman, one of the main tent groups coming to the Chippewa Falls Oktoberfest in just a couple weeks. Bruce Taylor and Patty C. are leading an upcoming workshop titled Memoir Writing at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls. We'll find out what to expect and how to sign up. Jim Oliver will also have, by the way, a look at what's on stage in Western Wisconsin, and there's lots going on. But this is our point of embarkation. Doug Hoverson is from Minnesota. He teaches there, and he wrote a book, a big book. I mean an all-inclusive book about Wisconsin's history with beer. I like beer. I liked the book. And I hope you like our conversation. You teach at a military academy for young men. You teach history and government. You coach debate, track, and the quiz bowl team. And you're the soccer announcer. You still find time to write what I consider the war and peace of history books about beer.
It probably weighs about that much, if not more.
I can use it as a doorstop. In fact, I will when I'm done with it. The drink that made Wisconsin famous, beer and brewing in the Badger State. Doug Hoverson, welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you very much.
This had to have taken a lot of work. How long did it take for you to compile all this stuff?
Well, it was about 11 years. What I've been telling people recently is it only took them 8 years to get Apollo to the moon.
Yeah.
2008, I started making fairly regular trips to spots in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Did you, looking ahead, think, wow, this is going to be a long time, or was it surprising how long it took?
In some ways, I think I was surprised, but part of that was really fun surprises because I kept finding more and more things that I didn't know about Wisconsin beer, but that I thought would be really interesting to include in the book. So it just kept opening layer after layer. I kept finding more people who were willing to help, and I kept finding puzzles that needed to be solved, and of course, many more breweries kept opening.
Now they're opening, but they were closing for a long time. We're all familiar with the big boys in Milwaukee, the Schlitzes, the Pabsts, Blatts, Miller. Braumeister was big at a time. Gettleman was big. The Heilemann guys in La Crosse and all over now. I don't know how Minnesota was, but I do know, and I grew up in Wisconsin on the eastern side of the state. When people talk about the good old days in Wisconsin, it's often mentioned that it seemed every town of size, even smaller ones, all had a brewery and a brand, but I read in one of your pieces here, there were a lot of small ones, and they were resistant to consolidation and contraction that changed the industry. The quote was, giving the impression that nearly every town in the Badger State had its own brewery. I had that impression.
Well, that's true. There are so many small towns and cities. There wasn't room for beer in all of them. That was especially true in the northwestern corner, where the area was settled much more recently, and there were a lot of loggers there. It was just simply easier to bring in the beer from Milwaukee or La Crosse or St. Paul, because mm-hmm. you do see a lot of old ham signs on the taverns out on the highway.
And, you know, you bringing up hams reminds me, relationships with beer goes back to our ability to sing the jingles.
That's very true. And that was one of the things everyone started doing when I talked about my first book, was just singing. From the land of sky blue waters.
Yeah. I'm from Milwaukee and I ought to know.
Yeah, the Blatz ones and what'll you have? Pabst Blue Ribbon.
There you go. The state has seen more than 800 breweries open and more than 650 close. Let's talk about Prohibition, because the brewing industry had a little problem with that. However, brewers made some interesting innovations. Was it true that some came up with ways to call themselves things other than beer? Were they called tonics, things supposedly good for you?
Well, there were several things that the breweries did. They did a lot of name changing. Some of them became the beverage company or the products company. They would make some near beers. And of course, the famous quote on that was, whoever called it near was a poor judge of distance.
Good quote.
But they also did have some of those tonics. Those actually predated Prohibition. They came around really in the 1890s as a patent medicine. Some of them were just a malt tonic, but some of them could have 5 or 6% alcohol. They were also kind of expensive to make, too, so they weren't going to be as useful a way to survive through the dry years.
Doug Hoverson with us. He's on the phone from Minnesota. He's the author of The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, Beer and Brewing in the Badger State. He's appearing at 5 p.m. on Wednesday, September 11th at Liney's Lodge. That's in Chippewa Falls. He's going to be talking about the book and signing copies. And if you like beer and if you like history, it's a great combination. What was it about beer? Why beer and why Wisconsin? Why did Wisconsin become famous for beer?
I think there were several factors that really came together all at once. And one of them, obviously, was the big migration of Germans to the state as it was being settled in the 1840s and 50s. Though it should be said that the first brewers were actually in the southwestern part of the state in the lead mining districts. Hmm. And so there were a few English brewers that got started earlier. But Wisconsin beer really blossoms when you get Germans moving in, the ready access to barley, good brewing water available, some of the other skilled people that are necessary too. You have to have coopers available, you have to have millers, and you have to have the skilled stonemasons that could build all of those cellars. So it was really a combination concentrated in Wisconsin, plus some really innovative marketing. Wisconsin beer wouldn't have become as famous as it was had it not been for people like Captain Fred Pabst and Val Blatz getting the word out and promoting themselves and their companies.
Unions played a big part in the beer industry, did they not?
They did, and that's really one of the things that I'm very proud of in the book, because I was able to talk to a bunch of brewery workers. There was a gentleman named Brian Zanevsky up in Appleton who helped me track down almost all of the workers who worked for George Walter Brewing Company in Appleton. And we had a lot of great stories. You think of the fun stories about working in a brewery, you get free beer, you know, it's a convivial place to work. But especially pre-Prohibition, there were a lot of dangers too. There were fires, explosions, hot liquids and hot surfaces. There were a lot of brewery workers who were injured on the job. And I think that also helped contribute to some of the unionization, and the brewery workers ended up being very influential.
Brewers were just by nature innovative. You talked about their marketing ability. I remember my father saved these little tear-off neck labels from the bottles of Kingsbury beer. They served like green stamps, and they were redeemable.
Yes, there's actually a picture of one of those in the book.
I saw a photograph that Blatz had a chewing gum.
They did. Another one of the ways the breweries got through Prohibition. They often had connections with stores and taverns, so they would sometimes move into distributing candy or gum or something else that used their existing retail channels.
Now, the gum didn't taste like beer, did it?
No, it didn't. They had several brands, but I think it was your standard. Grape is the one pictured in the book, and spearmint and cinnamon.
Okay. Quickly, about the evolution of brewing beer, what economic or manufacturing climates or upheavals caused so many breweries to close?
In Wisconsin, you had a number of buyouts, especially you mentioned Kingsbury. That was one of several that got bought out by Heilemann. But there was a lot of consolidation going on in American business at that point anyway.
Excuse me, let me just interrupt there. What point was that? Was there an apex of when breweries were going out of business wholesale?
The big time was during the period from after World War II and then into the 1980s. That
okay.
was the steep and steady decline.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. Continue.
So what was happening was the country was being connected better by rail and truck transport, so the larger breweries could start moving into some of the smaller markets they had previously left alone. Television advertising gave an advantage to the brewers looking for a national market. There was also a period in American consumer behavior when they generally were looking for a big, well-known national product, and the local product didn't have that same glamour anymore.
Craft brewing is huge. It's very popular nowadays. Doug, can this be viewed as a renaissance of the good old days, or is this a horse of a different color?
I think there's a lot of comparisons that you can make to brewing in the years immediately after the Civil War. You had a lot of people starting a new business. They stayed small at first, but they had a growth plan. One way, obviously, that today's craft brewers are a lot different is they're much more conscious about trying to either recreate old beer styles or create all new beer styles. Beers made today, especially some of the IPA styles, would be totally unrecognizable to Fred Pabst or Jacob Leinenkugel or another brewer if they came back from the late 19th century.
So much beer, so little time. Doug Hoverson, we appreciate you being with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And if we can, we're all going to stop over and see you on the 11th of September at 5 o'clock at Liney's Lodge. Thanks again.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Ah, the drink that made Wisconsin famous, beer and brewing in the Badger State. If you like beer, you'll love the book. Coming up on Spectrum West, Louis Anderson stops by, and if you have a memoir in your head, there's a way to put it on paper. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Support for WPR comes from Simply Dunn in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space for guests. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery and fair trade gifts. More at simply-dunn.com. Support also comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, a locally owned community bank, now offering new checking account options with personalized customer service. More information is available at charterbank.bank. Support also comes from Art Z Gallery in Amory, presenting An Expedition in Art with Nan Reinhardt's Fused Glass, Kyle Enman's photography, and Sue Cranston's abstract acrylic painting. ArtZGallery.org.
Into some polkas, grab another partner, polka time.
Well, Jim Oliver's always comfy talking with people from many vocations about any number of topics, but there are just a few where he's really in his element. Authors of a book he enjoyed, amateur theater people, anyone involved in the newspaper business, and musicians in a polka band.
I saw Esau sitting on a seesaw. I saw Esau sitting there. I saw Esau sitting on a seesaw.
And this week he talks with one who leads her own ensemble, and they'll be around here very soon.
The 17th annual Chippewa Falls Oktoberfest is slated for Friday through Sunday, September the 20th to the 22nd at the Northern Wisconsin State Fairgrounds in Chippewa Falls. The event includes lots of music, food, and games, and you might even find a beer garden or two. I counted 19 musical groups so far, and one of the featured bands in the event will be Barefoot Becky and the Ivanhoe Dutchman. On the telephone from Mount Vernon, Iowa, is Becky Livermore, probably better known as Barefoot Becky.
Yeah, if I talk on the phone and tell somebody, this is Becky Livermore, they'll go, who? Said, Barefoot Becky?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. And they're probably standing there with their coffee cup that says Barefoot Becky on it.
There you go.
I'm not going to bother to ask you where the Barefoot Becky came from because I figure you've been asked that 10,000 times. I'm just going to read out of your bio here. You started playing barefoot simply because it was more comfortable than playing with shoes on. I assume you perhaps may put shoes on in January or February or something.
Well, I do not own tie-up shoes. I have flip-flops that I wear all year round.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If I have to stand out there long, then I will put my flip-flops on and run out in the snow. But my husband does make me put a pair of boots and woolly socks in the van during the winter because he says, if we ever get in a wreck or we get stuck somewhere, I'm not carrying you.
Oh, yeah. That would be.
That was rude, but but I've never had to use them, thank goodness.
Okay. But one thing I did want to ask, the Ivanhoe Dutchman, where does that come from?
Well, Dutchman, simply because all the bands that I grew up listening to were called Dutchman. Six Fat Dutchman, Elmer Scheid, Two Ride Dutchman, Rainbow Valley Dutchman. So I thought, well, we've got to be Dutchman, too.
Oh.
Ivanhoe comes from the road that I live on south of Mount Vernon, Iowa. Grew up on Ivanhoe Road, moved away for a bit, and now we're back on Ivanhoe Road.
Uh-huh. Well, why don't you just tell me then how you got started? I read your bio, and it sounds like you fell in love with playing the accordion, sort of like I did years ago. Tell me how you got going and how you wound up leading a band.
Mom and Dad always took all of us kids dancing in Swisher, Iowa. We all learned how to dance, and I became interested in the music and the bands, and especially because one of our neighbors had a band, Ed Olch and the Jolly Bohemians, and I would go over to his house, and I wanted to take accordion lessons, so at the age of 10, I started accordion lessons, and I thought I should play in his band, of course. And I would bug him until he finally said, when you get good enough, kid, I'll call you. Well, he finally called.
Oh, well, hey.
When I was about 12 years old, it was an anniversary. It wasn't even a dance, like an open house. He played drums, I played accordion, he hired a tuba player. I played my very first, what I would call my real first job. Then he invited me to continue to play in his polka band through middle school and high school. And when he got to the point he talked about retiring, I said, I would love to buy your library and continue. And so when I was a senior in high school, I bought his library of music. Of course, my parents helped me out. We changed the name. I didn't really want to be a Jolly Bohemian.
Oh, well.
In the area that we're at, we are, you know, we have the National Czech and Slovak Museum, so there's a lot of Czechs in the area, but there are also a lot of Germans. We have the Amana Colonies, which is a German colony. You know, we kind of like that. We say we play half and half. So I wanted to be a Dutchman because that kind of spoke to me a little bit more than a Jolly Bohemian. So.
Oh.
We've renamed the band the Ivanhoe Dutchman, and here we are.
So what style of music do you play besides polka?
Yeah, we pretty much try to stick to the polka, and we do German, Czech, and a little bit of Slovenian. But I like country music as well, so we kind of do some of the old country songs, you know, a little bit of Cajun, a little bit of Latin, a little big band. Of course, party songs. You know, you play an Oktoberfest, got to do the chicken dance. Margaritaville, things like that. So we get into some of the party songs, too. Yeah.
She is Becky Livermore, who is probably better known as Barefoot Becky. Barefoot Becky and the Ivanhoe Dutchman Band, which will be playing at the Chippewa Falls Oktoberfest. Do you just play the same stuff over and over again, or do you pick up new tunes?
Try to pick up new tunes as times go by. You might hear another band play something that catches your ear, or there's just some songs that I've always wanted to play, and just a matter of, you know, finding the time to write up the arrangement.
Do you do the arrangements for the group?
Sometimes I do it myself. Other times I hire it out. Because with our band, we play with a full five-piece band, but we also downsize, and sometimes just my husband and I go out and do events, or we have a three-piece band that plays quite often. Basically, if I write the words and just play the song myself and practice it up and do it, that's about the only arrangement we have. Like I just play it by ear and just a matter right now, we're so busy, this is what we do full time, that it's just a matter of finding time to do things like that.
So many of the old ballrooms that I used to frequent are closed now, so you must have to do a lot of traveling.
We do. We play mainly Minnesota, Nebraska, Iowa, and Wisconsin. That's kind of our mainstay, but we branch all over the place. In the winter, we go down to Arizona and Texas. We do Kansas, Colorado. We've been over to Florida, Michigan, Ohio, anywhere and everywhere. So, yeah, we do a lot of traveling. It's really interesting when you talk to the old band leaders. Man, you guys travel a lot. You know, back in my day, I only had to go 50 miles, and I played 5 days a week, you know. Well, man, times have changed. You know, there was enough people dancing, and there was enough ballrooms. Every little town had a ballroom, and it really got supported. So times have changed. The dance craze, what it used to be, is not anymore.
Since you're so busy, when do you guys rehearse?
There is no rehearsal anymore.
Oh.
We come to the job, and it's kind of like, okay, got a new song, guys. Here we go.
Oh.
It's basic, you know, when we do a three-piece job, you know, as long as I can play it, you know, the rest of the band can fall in. It's not that difficult. If it's the full band and an arrangement where they have to read the music, well, then they have to sight read. Mm-hmm. We used to practice many, many, many years ago when we first started, and because we were bad.
No.
Everybody starts out at the same place, no matter what they tell you. Everybody starts out bad.
Yeah, well, sure.
Better. So, yeah, we did a lot of practicing, but we didn't have many jobs, so, geez, we could practice all the time. Now it's you wing it on the job, mm-hmm. and it gets easier.
As the evening wears on, you get better and better, I'm sure.
There you go.
Do you have any favorite bands that you would admired over the years or patterned yourself after or anything like that?
Who I first started listening to was actually a concertina player, Carl Hartwick, Carl and the Country Dutchman. Loved his playing. I thought he was very good. He still is very good. It's interesting. I styled myself after a concertina player. Started out with a little bit different style.
Mm-hmm.
When I was trying to get jobs, I'd send out this cassette to everybody, and they kept accusing me, that is not an accordion player. That is sounds like a concertina. This isn't even your band. And I was just devastated, you know. But he was one that I first listened to. Of course, Frankie Yankovic, Joey Miskulin. You can take something away from anybody that you listen to.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there was a lot of people that I listened to, but Carl was probably the first one that really caught my attention and really made me want to sit and learn to play the accordion.
Do you ever find yourself short and have to hire somebody locally to fill in?
The first 5 years that we played, we had the same musicians all the time. We never downsized. It was always five of us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got what they call a MIDI accordion so that I could play bass on my accordion. So then I didn't really need the tuba player or the bass player anymore. And then we could downsize into a three or four-piece band. So, you know, we do a lot of those jobs, and we travel so much, so I kind of have a pocket of musicians in Wisconsin, a pocket of musicians in Minnesota, Nebraska, Western Iowa, and here locally. They've all played with us so much, they all seem like regulars. There's not too many times where I have to use somebody that's never played with us before, but it happens.
We've been talking to Becky Livermore of the Barefoot Becky and Ivan O. Dutchman Band, playing from 7:15 to 11 p.m. Friday, September the 20th, at Chippewa Falls Oktoberfest at the Northern Wisconsin State Fairgrounds. The event will continue through Sunday. Becky, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you much.
Well, of course, Mr. Oliver does double time, as usual, with What's on Stage in Western Wisconsin. Here he is again.
Thank you, sir. Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors, One Siren at a Time, will be presented by the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson, September 13th to the 15th, the 20th to the 22nd, and the 27th to the 29th. The Festival Theater will present The Somewhat True Tale of Robin Hood, September 13th to the 15th, and the 19th to the 22nd in the Franklin Square Black Box Theater in St. Croix Falls. The Outsider, a political farce, will be presented in the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson, Fridays and Saturdays, September 13th through the 26th. The St. Croix Art Barn of Osceola will present Blithe Spirit, September 12th through the 15th. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild has scheduled auditions for Duck Hunter Shoots Angel at 7 p.m. Monday and Tuesday, September 9th and 10th, in the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. And the Stagehands Theater of Spring Valley will hold auditions for Charles Dickens' The Christmas Carol from 4:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. September 23rd and 24th in the Spring Valley Theater.
Thank you, sir. You know, it's been said there's a writer inside everyone. Not sure who said that. Maybe it's just me, but I think it's true. Putting thoughts on paper, either with a writing appliance or a keyboard, feels somewhat natural. We all have experiences we remember, and some of them we'd like to leave behind. I think that's an ordinary guy's definition of a memoir. Bruce Taylor and Patty C., a couple, and a couple of writers, have written volumes, and they'll share their experience with anyone who'd like the assistance in a workshop coming later this month. Three words that stood out to me in the description of this workshop are interested in writing. And I wondered if that is a common trait, because we are so bombarded with things designed to interest us today. Is the need to write innate in us humans?
I think so. You know, I recently, as part of trying pieces of this out, I did a thing at Senior Day at the university on life writing, writing for your life. Okay. And the first thing I did when I walked in the room, there's a huge crowd there. I said, well, how many people are keeping a journal or something in which you write every day? And a few hands went up. And I said, how many people have kept a journal or something like that, but gave it up? And even more hands came up. And then I said, how many of you have always wanted to keep a journal, but have never got around to doing it? And then even more hands went up. Mm-hmm. So by the end of it, pretty much everybody in the room had their hand up.
Well, and we look at culturally how many people from, you know, 8-year-olds to 88-year-olds text their life. So I think we're compelled to tell stories. It just takes different formats. And if you look at Facebook, maybe too many people telling too many mundane stories about their lives. But I think that people are really compelled to tell their stories.
I've asked this of many people who are in the literary field over the years. Should you, when you sit down to write, think about the people you're writing for or just write?
Any writer thinks about audience and purpose, but in the beginning, I don't think that you need to consider who's going to be reading this or for what purpose. I think that the first step is get the words out.
Writing something, you know, whether it's just general journaling or in this case, I'm sure we will come up with some in the early sessions when we're talking about journaling. I hate to say it, you know, it, memoir.
You don't like that word.
No. I think the one thing that I try to stress lately is that it's so easy to find what they call writing prompts, which, you know, are ideas to write about, or as you said, something to write about. And to me, something to write about isn't the deal. I try to present exercises, things that are going to make you a better writer. They're going to strengthen your writing, your ability to observe, to remember, your imagination. I'm just saying write about your trip to the zoo. You know, I might say write about your trip to the zoo and to the supermarket and tell me what you find similar.
And yet, I've heard that writing takes a lot of work. And then I hear from other people that it shouldn't take a lot of work. You should just do it.
I think that it does take a lot of work. And I think that the act of a first draft perhaps doesn't take a lot of work, but the work comes in the editing stage and rearranging and the research stage. And so I think that writing is a lot of work.
That's one of the things that oftentimes scares people away from writing about their life, is they think, this is a lot of work. You know, this is something beyond me. This
I don't
is something
have time.
I can't do. I don't have time. Yeah. And so the second thing you said here, when you said some people say just do it, is really important initially. One of my favorite poets, William Stafford, gave the best advice on writer's block I've ever heard. And he said, if a writer has writer's block, it's not that they can't write, it's that they can't write something that they think is good. And he said, lower your standards. So I've made a living for years as a writing teacher saying, lower your standards.
Yeah, so. That's good advice. Bruce Taylor and Patty C. in the studio with us. They write, not for a living, but because of living, I guess. Memoir writing is the name of their workshop. You could call it something else, and they wouldn't mind. It's a half dozen Saturdays beginning on the 28th of September, going through November 2nd, coming up at the Heide Center, and that, of course, is in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. So we determined that we have an interest in writing. What does writing accomplish for us in our lives? We measure the things we eat, the exercise we get, the rest we need. Where does writing and expressing ourselves lie on the chart of things that are good for us?
Oh, I got that one.
You got that one?
Yeah. You write for the same reason you should pray every day. You write for the same reason you should floss every day, even if you don't. You write for the same reason you should exercise, spend quality time with your pets. You write for those reasons because it's good for you. And if it's good for you, makes you better, it's good for the world. It makes the world better.
What does it do? Does it get stuff out of your head and off your shoulders?
It increases your ability to observe and to empathize and to communicate, to weigh things and value things. It's exercise.
So once you start writing, you will want to write more if you're doing it right.
In theory, I don't know about that as a generalization, but yeah. I will say that I think that if anybody sits down, like so many things, with a little instruction and a lot of practice, you can get to be a lot better at writing than you were when you started.
Oh. So now, Patty, Bruce has been here many times. A couple things stood out to me when I did my research. You are somewhat renowned for a blog about your family's encounter with Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that you wrote letters. It was mandatory that you wrote letters to sisters of yours. And thus, maybe not thus, but you became a writer.
Yeah, absolutely. My mom loved letter writing. My brothers tease that our mom was the original Facebook because she told everything in her letters. And I'm the youngest of eight. There are 19 years between myself and my oldest sister. So when I was born, one sister was already out of the house. By the time I started kindergarten, a lot of my siblings were out of the house. So I grew up writing letters to sisters who live far away. Some of my family members are borderline hoarders. So one sister saved every letter that I'd ever written to her. I started writing when I was about five. And so,
is she keeping them or giving them to you?
She just recently gave them to me.
She did.
So maybe she's not a true hoarder if she
gave
them
back. Fun to read, I'll bet.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And in those letters, absolutely, I'd map out anything that happened. I just wrote a column for the Leader Telegram about getting one of those letters back. And in the letter I wrote when I was 7 or 8 years old, I recounted the first time I went to Lake Halley. And that I almost drowned and my best friend pulled me out.
Wow.
And now I live on Lake Halley and I can look out my kitchen window and see that spot. And so when I got that letter back, I took a picture of it and I sent it to the friend, my best friend Karen, who'd pulled me out by the hair. So I think that's one example of how you write your experiences, but you don't know the impact they're going to have on your future self. And I think a lot of people who might be attracted to a life writing workshop want to recount what has happened in their lives for grandchildren or children, or they just want to process some of their best stories.
Mm-hmm. So you don't like memoir writing. Memoirs are writing for life is kind of the term you use.
Say it with me now. Memoir.
Yes, right.
It's a little too uptown. It's a little too fancy.
And there's too many of them out there.
One of the problems that we have immediately when we talk about life writing, writing for your life, is oftentimes people say, who am I, what have I done, what's happened to me? I don't have memoir, but maybe you have a story. Some stories, One of the first steps we have to take is to make people realize that life is worth writing about. It's valuable. What they have to say, their observations are valuable. And in order to sort of, that's one of the first steps to free yourself to do this kind of writing. Oftentimes we run into people, particularly new parents. We just plead with them. You've got to keep some kind of, even just a few lines a day. You have to, because you know those things you say you're never going to forget? You're going to forget them.
Yeah. And you say, it's not for me that I'm asking you to do this. It's for you.
Right.
Who knows? The great-grandchild that picks up the thing, or a stranger who finds the journal in a secondhand store tucked away somewhere in the corner.
I'm in the audience, and I've been listening to what we've been talking about, and I'm considering attending your workshop. What should I know that can take me over the edge to actually sign up?
It's fun.
Yeah.
It's good for you. everybody will learn stuff.
Nice planning, too. 10 to noon on a Saturday is a wonderful time for this.
I would also add that if someone is a closet writer and wants to put something together more formally and take a chance, this workshop is going to be really welcoming to beginners. It's going to be welcoming to anybody who has written or published before. So we're looking forward to covering a lot of different aspects of life writing.
All right. How do we sign up? Do we just go to cvca.net, Chippewa Valley Cultural Association, better known as the Heide Center website?
That is correct.
Yeah. And we are limited to how many people can be in this. So if you're really interested, you probably ought to jump in early.
So when people leave this workshop, what are they going to leave with?
They'll leave with hopefully some new work, or if they want to bring in some work that they've already started, we're hoping that they walk away understanding how to tell a good story. We're going to focus on observation, absolutely focus on research. We'll talk about memory. We'll talk about imagination.
Is it important for writers to hang out with other writers, or is it okay to just be a solo?
I think it depends on your personality, but I always say my students should be around other writers. They might say one thing, half a sentence one time, that's going to be the most important thing you've ever heard about writing. You don't know if it's going to happen or when it happens, but you've got to be there to hear it.
Also, writers steal from each other.
Sure,
borrow.
Very important.
There's one reason to
and
hang
inspire,
out. And inspire,
too.
And inspire.
Or they like what someone said and they word it differently.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What does Eliot say? Mature poets steal and immature poets borrow.
Oh, there you go. Thank you guys for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Memoir writing. There you go, Bruce Taylor and Patty C. It begins September 28th at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls. Again, the website is cvca.net. Hey, we'll be talking with Louis Anderson next on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Charter Bank of Eau Claire, a locally owned community bank now offering new checking account options with personalized customer service. More information is available at charterbank.bank. Support also comes from Simply Done in Downsville, offering fair trade gifts and a space for meetings, retreats, or classes in their historic schoolhouse overlooking the Red Cedar Valley. Simply-dunn.com.
Poor 11 kids. I had 11 kids in my family. I was 10th. I just slid out. I was I was home before my mom from the hospital, so I had to fend for myself. But me and my brother Tommy was 2 years younger than me, and we were the last two kids. We weren't expected or planned for. We were just, oh my God, we have two more.
Louis Anderson is a household name in comedy. 30 plus years on the big stage will do that. He's also been on the big screen, the smaller screen, within hit shows like Life with Louis, Family Feud, and his current role on the FX hit Baskets. But his first love is stand-up comedy, and he'll be standing on the stage of the Mabel Tainter Theater in Menominee Saturday evening, September 21st. We talked with the Minnesota native earlier this week as he fought off the final stages of a cold, caught, he believes, on the set of Coming to America 2, which he just completed.
I shook a lot of hands and said hi to a lot of people.
Can't have too much hand sanitizer for that.
Yeah, but you know, when you're in the middle of it, you know, the hand sanitizing in some ways seems rude. How's everything going?
Oh, good. The last time you and I talked, we talked about Tim Harmston and Mary Mack.
Yeah.
Their wedding and stuff. That was fun.
Yeah. They're great people.
Yeah, they are. Congratulations on that Coming to America, too. That's cool.
Yeah, that was a really nice surprise, you know, to get that call and say, hey, will you do it? And I said, will I? Yeah, that was 30 years coming. People have been asking me, when are you going to do another Coming to America? It was a lot of fun.
I have forever loved Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and I didn't have any idea you were in it.
Yeah, I'm a quick blink.
Yeah.
I heard they're going to try and do another one.
All these sequels. They're good movies, so why not, huh?
Yeah, why not? I think people love nostalgia, and people have families now, and they can bring their family to it. I think we live in that kind of thing. I think we love to revisit stuff that's fun for us, don't you?
Oh, sure.
Like The Godfather, you know. It's like if I come across The Godfather on TV when I'm scrolling, it's hard for me to go past it. Yeah, it's just such a beautiful movie, you know, especially Godfather 2.
I want you to know who you're sharing the show with. Iowa polka legend Barefoot Becky.
Wow.
She's pretty dynamic.
Yeah, that sounds like a fantastic person.
Yeah, and a gentleman who wrote a book about Wisconsin's history with beer.
Oh, wow.
And he lives in Minnesota.
Was that my dad?
He lives in Minnesota, and he also wrote a book about the beer industry in Minnesota. So that should ring true.
Yeah, yeah, that beer stuff, yeah.
Do you like beer?
I like a beer once in a great while. But no, I've never been a beer person. I used to drink that Schmidt Extra Special with a shot of anisette.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I hardly ever drink unless it's a really good bottle of champagne. I'll take a sip out of that.
Good. Well, it appears you and I haven't talked since October of 2012. And when you get to be our age, you know, you simply can't lop off seven-year chunks at a time. It goes fast enough as it is. So
yeah, that's true.
So let's plan on speaking more often, okay?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, congratulations. Since we last spoke, you have taken home some hardware, an Emmy, and a Critics' Choice Award for Best Supporting Actor. That was neat.
Yeah, that is a cool thing.
I watched the YouTube videos of those wins. As impressive as they are, I have to comment on your formal wear, because you seem to have some wonderful neck brooches that you wear, kind of blingy in a way. How much Minnesota is left in Louis Anderson? Does it ever get replaced?
I'll tell you a great story about the first brooch. I was in baskets. The first AD, Sally Sulander, who's a great first AD, for assistant director, you know, she says, "Oh, my mom loves you." And I said, "Oh, how is your mom?" "You know, she's good." I said, "You should call her. You should give your mom a call and tell her I said hi." And she did. And shortly after that, her mom died.
Oh, boy.
And that brooch, that was her mother's brooch.
Yeah, you had two different ones on, I noticed. One at the Emmys and one at the Critics' Choice.
Yeah, and the other one was one of my mom's pieces of jewelry. So they were really more sentimental. And I also hate those neckties. You know, those are two pieces that were really from one mother and one was from another. And with me playing the mother, I just felt like they were appropriate.
Yeah, and I'm really glad I asked, because that's a cool story. I didn't really know. I thought maybe you just turned into a Rodeo Drive guy. I didn't know.
Yeah, I do like to look nice, but I love a linen jacket and a casual shirt.
Sure.
I'm really a Midwesterner at heart.
Good. I can see and hear there is still some Minnesota left in you. Good for you.
I was just back in Minnesota playing at the Withrow Ballroom. And once a week they have polka, which I really love. When you brought up the polka.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that kind of stuff. You know, I don't want her. You can have her. She's too fat for me.
In fact.
I don't think you can even say that anymore, can you? I don't want her. You can have her.
Yeah, no, probably not. But see, now what that causes me to do is to fast forward to a different question that I had for you that was scheduled to come a little later on in the conversation. I was going to bring up the fact that you truly have become a well-rounded entertainer. You have done stand-up. You've been successful in an animated series. You've had movie and TV roles, and you're an author. And I was about to end it by saying the only thing that's left is music. And I was going to say, are you saving that for a big finish?
You know, I have toyed with the idea of doing an album as Christine Baskett.
Oh, yeah.
Love songs by Christine Baskett.
Well.
Or love songs and ballads, maybe, huh?
Yeah.
You know, my dad was a musician, so I know there's some talent in me.
What did he play?
He was a trumpet and cornet player for Hoagy Carmichael.
Wow.
Hoagy came to our house once, and my dad was too embarrassed because we lived in the projects. It was pretty embarrassing. But, you know, I think I get some of my talent certainly from him.
Yeah. Louis Anderson on the phone with us. He's coming to Western Wisconsin, playing the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts. Beautiful place. Saturday, September 21st. 8 p.m. His cold will be gone by then. All right, so we've talked about these other entertainment outlets that you're good at and things that you're pondering. Tell me how or if those work together to grow the man. I'm guessing they may each provide material for the others.
I think what happens is, you know, like, first of all, you get fans from each one of them. So that's kind of a nice, diverse thing.
That's true.
The TV is a 12-hour-a-day job. You're really doing nothing else but working, getting something to eat, and going to bed. You're getting up and getting there at 5 or 6. You're working 12 to 15 hours, and you're going to bed. You can't wait to get to bed, and you get up at 5 again. So you get into a groove there. When you're into it, it's really good, and it's a lot of work. But when you're doing stand-up, you're traveling, which is your work. That's the work part of it, I think. And then you get there, and then you have this wonderful relationship with an audience, as close as a relationship can be without spending more time with them. But it's very intimate and very heartfelt, and I try to be as wide open as possible in that performance.
Uh-huh.
With movies, you sit around and wait. You know, they do a scene. They take a minimum of 20 minutes to set up a scene. Then you turn it around, and that takes 20 minutes, and then you go in close. And so they all have their own thing, and I enjoy each part of them. But stand-up, you know what's so great about stand-up? You grab your jacket, a suitcase. You don't have a producer. There's no turning it around. There's no writer. There's no director. It's very clean. It's very nuanced. It's really the greatest thing. The stand-up is my first love, and I still get a tremendous amount of joy. And I've been going through all my material lately. I've recorded hundreds of shows.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been going through all my material and pulling out stuff that I haven't developed that was in that material, and I'm doing that.
Oh, good.
And then
yeah.
I took all these other, I put a bunch of jokes together that are just really killer jokes. Been moving them around and slamming them all together at a show, and it's so much fun because they're killer jokes. They're great jokes.
I think one of the things we talked about last time had to do with the moment you come up with the perfect punchline, and it often comes spontaneously on stage, whereas you had been searching for it for years.
Yeah, it happened. That happened to me. I had another good example. I was on stage, and somebody just before I performed said, you know, Louis, I really like you, but I don't like when you do those jokes about your weight. I really think you should embrace yourself. So I told that story on stage, and then the joke came. I go, well, I would embrace myself if I could get my arms around me.
I saw
and
that
coming. That's a really Midwestern joke. That's a response from a Midwesterner for somebody saying something like that. You know what I mean? I've always thought my jokes were not about making fun of me. I thought they were just making fun of the circumstances. You know, I'm not a fat person. I'm a person who happens to be fat.
There you go.
You know, and my addiction, I talk a little bit about it, food addiction, what that's like. You know, my goal is to make people feel really good, not guilty, not burdened. I want them to feel free. I'm going to free myself up on stage, and I want them to free themselves up as an audience. And if they do that, they'll get more out of me, and I'll get more out of them. If we decide that there aren't any barriers, we just go, we're just going to see some, we'll get to see the sparks, the electricity. You get to see the jokes being created. I love the idea. I have this knack for being able to create some stuff on stage, and I just love it. I can't tell you how it makes me feel better even talking about it.
You know, I watched, you talked about your jokes about weight. In prep for this conversation, I watched your 1984 appearance on The Tonight Show. That's 35 years ago, man. And you dove in with that right at the beginning, and you were a hit. It was wonderful to watch. It seems to me that a lot of stuff that happened to you, some specials and things like that, did come in the span of maybe the next 3-4 years after that appearance on The Tonight Show. So it is, or was, true that a person who made an appearance and killed it on Johnny Carson's show reaped the benefits.
You know, when I got on that Tonight Show, the next day, I flew to Vegas and opened, you know, at the Comedy Store with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next week, I got the job opening at Bally's for the Commodores. And NBC made a holding deal with me, gave me a bunch of money. And all that stuff happened immediately.
Hmm.
that next week. And I thought, wow, thank you, Johnny.
No kidding.
I mean, it was just that powerful.
Yeah. Hey, just one more question. I see that season 4 of Baskets is airing as we speak, and it's legendary that the other Louis C.K., and Zach cast you to play a matronly woman. Have they ever told you where that notion came from, that you'd be good at that?
Well, Zach said he had a sound, you know, for the mother. And he went, and Louis said, you mean Louis Anderson? And Zach said, yeah. And Louis said, should we call him? And they called me.
And you said,
yeah. Story, and it's true, you know. The director was there. Everybody was there.
And you had such a wonderful role model in Orizella Anderson, and it just took off from there. Way to go.
It did.
Well, Wisconsin folks might not appreciate many things about Minnesota, but the State Fair and Louis Anderson are a couple good ones. Louis, thanks again for being with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking forward to seeing you in Menominee, Wisconsin at the Mabel Tainter Center. Take care of your cold.
You know, your interview is so much fun.
Thanks, man.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Funny guy. Nice guy. Louis Anderson. MabelTainter.org is the website. If you're not convinced to go see him now, I don't think anything can take you over the top. Let's shoot out some Spectrum memos for you while we still have a minute or two. The 14th Bluegrass Festival is this Friday through Sunday at Pioneer Village Museum near Cameron. Music, food, and refreshments all weekend long. Acoustic instrument workshop Saturday. It's rain or shine. PioneerVillageMuseum.org. Saturday, it's Art on the Kinney in River Falls, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. 70-plus art vendors, live music on two stages, food activities for kids. It's free. RiverFallsCAB.org. It's the 10th season at the Wide Spot in Stockholm, and it begins with Going Coastal, the radio variety show that's not on the radio. That's coming up Sunday, 7 p.m., WideSpotPerformingArts.org. At the Mabel Tainter this weekend, it's the Stefan Geisinger Blues Band. And that happens Saturday. Next week, we'll be talking about and with, well, about the music and with the guy who makes the music, Kevin McMullen. He's coming to Eau Claire. And band from Portland, Oregon, Ezra Bell. They're also paying us a visit on the radio and in person. Big milestone show next week. Thanks to Dean and Kate, new interns just getting their feet wet. Thanks, Jim Oliver. And thanks, you guys, for listening. See you next week.